It's always great to have my colleagues on the podcast discussing their latest research, their professional service, teaching methods, and other initiatives. It's even better when I can get one particular person in the studio to get the highest perspectives on all things business. Today, my guest is Dr. Amjad Abdulat, Dean of the Engler College of Business. Roll the intro.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today.
I've known this man for nearly 30 years now. I remember when he joined the faculty in the late 90s and how he made his way up the ladder in administrative positions. He's been dean of the college since February of 2020, which, if you might recall, was only a few weeks before a pandemic rocked our world, as well as how we would deliver classes for a while. What a way to start a new job, Amjad. I mean, think about that. That wasn't on your bingo card.
No, it was not.
Amjad, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you here. We're going to have just a kind of like a fireside chat with the dean here about a few interesting topics affecting business and how we teach and the curriculum, things like that. Amjad, let's start out by talking about the future of colleges and schools of business. We can include things like curriculum, accreditations, enrollment challenges, and so forth. What's your take on the future of where we're going?
Well, thank you, Nick. I still remember the day I joined the college long time ago, and I still remember when I was presented with the opportunity to be a dean, I thought things would be easier, but every year something different comes, but COVID was the biggest challenge probably we all encountered. I think what is happening in business education is really right now it is at an inflection point. Because the expectations from students, from employers, from society are changing faster than the traditional academic models that we built, and we cannot handle that expectations in the same speed that the expectation is needed. Business education is not broken, but parts of it are outdated. And if we don't move faster, the market will pass us by. And there is, if you take a look at the industry, you see many companies don't exist anymore because they really did not respond and they were not agile. And if we are talking about business schools or regional business schools, the challenge is more challenging, if you will. The future is not about abandoning what we do well. It is going to be about evolving how we deliver and how fast we adapt and how closely we are connected to the real world. So what that means is degrees are no longer a product. So when somebody gets a degree, it is not a product anymore. Now, outcomes. So what that means is degrees are outcomes. What skills you have, what you have learned, how you are going to apply it. And if a student does not see clear return, they are going to walk away from educations. And when you add AI right now into the challenge, then it makes it more difficult. So adding one AI courses is not the solutions. It's not innovations. It is something that we need to make sure that AI need to be embedded in the curriculum. Otherwise, it will not be what it is. From a regional schools, the competition is huge for enrollment because if you take a look at the demographic is declining in rural areas and where most regional schools are. So if the regional schools are not willing to adapt and try to be more responsive to the change, then they might be facing different kind of challenges.
The curriculum is never etched in stone. It has to evolve just like everything else is evolving. I've been here long enough to know that there have been classes that have fallen out of our curriculum, but others have suddenly sprung up, like my digital marketing class. It started out as e-commerce based because in the 90s, that's all we had as a new thing, e-commerce. But then social media came along, and then digital marketing now is, it's a huge field. And in fact, it's about 3/4 of all marketing dollars spent these days. So the curriculum had to change along with everything else that was changing. Can you give me some examples of other classes like
well,
this?
Well, you know, when you talk about curriculum, curriculum in traditional academic institutions, it takes a long time to really make the change because you have to go through so many things. And sometimes by the time you make the change, you wonder whether it is the right change. I'll give you a story. Back in the 80s, the auto industry, well, the U.S. auto industry was in trouble because it used to take them 3 years to take an idea of a new car or new vehicle and put it in the showroom, 3 years, where the Japanese, it was 18 months. Now the Korean, they could do that in 7 to 9 months. However, in higher educations, we have not changed, especially public schools, because you have to go through so many processes. In general, curriculum, when we talk about curriculum, there are two things we need to be careful about. There's a curriculum relevance and curriculum stability, because when you are going to work about the relevance and stability, there's a strategic tensions that happens between those two. So innovations versus academic rigor and accreditation stability, because when you make a change, then you need to worry about assessment, you need to worry about how the accreditations and the process. So when we try to talk about changing curriculum, is you definitely need to take a holistic approach. You can't just add a course or add a topic. What you really wanted, especially nowadays, is, for example, if we are talking about skills with the AI. AI now can write reports, build financial models, generate marketing campaign, perform analysis. So what the students needs to do then? Well, we need to show students how to frame a problem. We need to show students how to interpret data and how to be able to make decisions in an uncertain world. So the type of curriculum is not just to add topic. It's going to be embedded in all of those courses across the curriculum in order for us to be to achieve this. You mentioned your course. Your course, probably when you came up with your course, you were a pioneer. And your course has evolved and changed dramatically. Now, if the course is not coupled with tools and skills, then it becomes just a theory, if you will. It's like if you teach somebody how to drive or how to fly by a simulations, they need to be behind the wheels in order for them to become a good drivers.
And yet there will always be bread and butter courses that will never go away, right? Like the principles of marketing or management or finance, whatever. Those are the foundations upon which all the new courses are built.
Yes. The challenge for us in higher education is we have the principal courses or the base knowledge, if you will. But if you really don't take a robust, comprehensive, holistic approach, how you change the curriculum, you really are just only changing courses. So it really needs to be really take a holistic approach from all of those courses and see how they fit together. Otherwise, there will be fragmented efforts. There will be islands of topic across the curriculum. So what we need to do is we need to integrate them and build on them. That's how we can improve the curriculum. This is why the curriculum is, the schools needs to be agile to be able to respond. Now, not only you have, for public schools, you have the coordinating board, you have the processes in place, but also you have accreditations. And when you have all of those things together, there is a competing interest of how you move, of how fast you can move. And it makes it more challenging. So schools like ours needs to be more able to respond fast and to be agile by being strategic about where they want to make the change. You can't change the entire curriculum, so you need to be more surgical to go and say, well, I think I want to go into that area. This is where the change I need to make, because these are the skills I need to have my students to have.
I've been here working for 5 different deans. That's a lot.
I'm not going to ask you who's your favorite dean, so don't worry about that.
Okay. But when I came, we had only 2 programs. We had a BBA. We had an MBA. But now we've got several graduate programs, and that is in large part due to changes in the marketplace, demand for certain skill sets. Can you address this part of being the dean and being able to see into the future and having an idea of what we need to be doing next with our programs?
Well, I think for graduate program in particular, there is a massive changes happening in the landscape of business educations. What you are seeing right now is there is the traditional approach is becoming almost obsolete because you have students now, they want to have shorter period of time. So they don't want to go for 15 weeks. They want to go for 8 to 10 weeks because that will be more flexible to their lifestyle, to their schedule, to their work schedule. So shorter semesters are one. Second, what you are seeing, there's a huge competitions between schools in terms, especially on the online. Most graduate programs now, especially at the master level, and some in the doctoral level, is going online. And what that means is now you are competing with larger schools. And so the marketing components of higher education, of your programs, becomes very expensive. The niche program, like the business analytics, like an AI, if you will, like MSFE, the one we have, is we can compete with that on the marketplace when it comes to advertising and to be able to have an outreach effort. But if you are not careful, then you are going to be able not to make the changes you want to make if you are going to do all of those programs. So some schools, they try to have more of a core competencies of program or courses that matches their faculty skills, type of students they attract. And I think that's what you are going to see, is you're not going to have a menu of programs. You are going to have a very focused programs that each school will specialize in those.
I have to bring up online because you've already said that magic word. We didn't start doing this until 1997, but boy, did it take off. And I know even back then, we were all thrilled to be doing it, but deep inside, we were worried that one day we're going to wake up like the beginning of a fall semester and we've got 3,000 students on our front porch all wanting to take classes. We eventually did grow considerably. It was nice to have that. And thankfully, it didn't happen overnight. But I think more than anything, our success in the online arena reflects our ability to adapt. We did adapt quickly, even though, as with all things new, there was some naysaying. But we got over that and we figured out that this is something that we need to do in order to remain competitive. That was 29 years ago.
I think you were the pioneer when it came to online. If I recall correctly, you were the first faculty who taught online. So you probably have seen how things are. And what you are seeing right now is online is here to stay. So whether you agree or disagree with it, it is here. Now, the challenge for the online education is going to be is how you deliver it, the modality of it, the support you have behind it. So in the past, it used to be, you know, you just will have, at best, maybe you will have like a recorded message or slides and you talk about them. I think that model has gone. This is not the way it is right now. So now we worry about animations, about gamifications when you are going the teaching. So the tools that are required to be competitive is going to be more expensive, require different skills. And that's what educational institutions are going to do. Before COVID, there were less than 100 schools that offer online programs. And now probably every school in the nation does offer online programs. So what that means is there's 3,000 schools now offer online education. I'm talking about business educations. So what you are seeing now is business schools and institutions have recognized how they can scale the online and they can see the value of it, the financial reward that they would have, because they can scale it in such a way it will be profitable to them. There are schools like, I don't want to mention school names, but very flagship schools have gone from being the full program to be on the ground to be fully online. And now what they are doing is they're cutting from a 14-week semester to 8-week semester, where students will take one or two courses every eight weeks. But behind that, there's a huge technical infrastructures to change the modality and how to do. For us, as we need to adapt to the new technology. What that means is, as you recall, is many people said, what is online? They don't have nothing to do with it. So we are going in the same cycle. Maybe this is 2.0 online, is we need to really add more skill sets to our faculty to be able to adapt to the type of courses that are going to be required and how they are delivered.
I remember when I taught my first courses online, it wasn't enough that I was a subject matter expert. I also had to be a programmer. I had to build my own classes in HTML because we didn't have Canva or Blackboard or anything like
sure.
that. We had actually, our IT people had built our own WT class system
in PHP. Yeah.
And it was good. It was very good, especially for a homegrown system. But it was also difficult for whoever was teaching a class because they had to learn how to do other things that were way outside their normal scope of knowledge. It stretched me pretty thin, having to learn HTML. I mean, I learned how to think inside brackets.
One thing is, I think what you are seeing is at least online is becoming, if you're not careful, it become like a commodity. It will become like on the credit cards or the airlines. So you need to differentiate it. And if you don't differentiate your product by the quality of the delivery and the mm-hmm. quality of instructions, then you cannot distinguish your MBA from another MBA. And that is what's really happening. There's a saturations in the marketplace that they are look-alike. And those programs that will thrive and improve will be the one that they will adopt the new technology. They will be able to infuse a new skill set with the faculty that they can differentiate themselves. So MBAs, in term of, if you think of a credit card, I mean, all the credit cards are the same, but companies or banks try to differentiate them by different things. And the same thing is going to happen to the academic program for the online programs.
Let's talk about accreditation a little. When I arrived here in 89, we were not accredited. It was not even a word that we talked about for a variety of reasons. But I recall in the late 90s, a fairly new accrediting agency coming about, and it was decreed by a former dean that we should pursue this. And so I was on that committee that put together all these documents and so forth to demonstrate why we were worthy of being accredited by them. But then fast forward on into the first decade of the 21st century, Dr. Terry had the vision for us to let's climb another rung on this ladder here and seek accreditation with AACSB, which fortunately we did, and we have maintained that relationship. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of obligations and so forth. You know this, obviously, but can you speak to the importance of being accredited, and not just accredited, but accredited by the highest accrediting agency in the field?
Fortunately, our programs are accredited by AACSB, and we have gone through three accreditation cycles. The credit, as you mentioned, goes to Dr. Terry. I remember back when he became a dean, that was one of his tasks and vision that we wanted to be accredited. And I remember when we first went to Tampa to know exactly the lay of the land about accreditations. Accreditations allow you to be recognized as you are in the top 10% of business schools in the world. And if you are not accredited by AACSB, it means that you have not passed the muster, because AACSB focuses on the quality of the faculty and the credential of the faculty and their research, the quality of their research, that your programs are rigor and academically sound. And so basically is it really bring more of a leveling field between small schools and big schools. For example, UT Austin is accredited by AACSB. We are accredited by AACSB. The challenge for schools like ours is to be able to be accredited is requires lots of hard work from both the administrators and the faculty. It requires assessment. It requires, you have to hire different kind of faculty. So it becomes very expensive sometimes to be able to maintain the standards. And what AACSB does is it allows you to be able to standardize your approach to a assessment like everybody else. So when you are saying we are accredited by AACSB, you are saying we are in an elite club that only 7 to 10% of schools in the world are accredited by this. What AACSB does is it held you accountable to what you claim. So every 5 to 6 years, a team will come here, and basically it takes us 2 years to do our what's so called CIR report. And that report is to tell them how we are meeting the standards. And every 7 years, WACSB changes those standards. So you need to be more of in tune into the changes of those standards about many things. Fortunately, we went through three cycles, and in 28, 29, we'll go with our fourth cycle. And I think accreditation makes the schools a better schools. Yes, you really have to ensure strategic planning, assessment, quality of faculty, but if you really reflect on it, it forces you to be able to hold accountable to an external entities to be the best you can be. So some people may have different feelings, different opinion, but I think accreditations forces you to hold your standards and to ensure that the academic rigor and the quality of the faculty always will be there. It gives you self-reflections about what you are, who you are, how you do things, and definitely it makes you a better school.
Earlier you mentioned population decline or stagnation in rural areas, and that's definitely a problem as people seem to be attracted to the big cities. There's a lot of jobs there, lots of opportunity and so forth. And so, yeah, we've experienced that here, as have many other rural areas and regional schools around the country. But there's another force that we've been kicking around in academia for a while, and that is the so-called demographic cliff that universities collectively are going to be running off of here very soon. And it all ties to the 2008 recession, after which the birth rate in the U.S. plummeted. We have not had a year of 4 million live births since before the recession. And, well, you know, universities thrive on churn. You know, students come, students go. We really do want to see them leave, with a degree, of course, but that means we have to replace them. If the pool of potential students is declining, that's going to present some problems, especially in the more rural areas. What's your take on all this?
Well, I that's a challenge everybody's facing. And it's, even if you take a look, not only the decline in birth rates, but also very fewer students now are going back to, are going to get college degrees. They are electing to go and pursue different opportunities. And you have like the micro-credentialing, the certificates is something that is now students can learn skills not coming to college but going somewhere else. We really this is a national challenge. It's not only unique to specific areas, but if you take a look at the the United States map, you will find that schools, that there are states are growing. Texas, luckily, Texas is one of the states that has a tremendous growth. You will find North Carolina is another state, if you will. Colorado is another state. So we are in a growth state, but we are not in a growth geographical area. So what that means is we have to really work harder to attract students from outside our region to be able to stay competitive. And we need to find different methods, different approaches to encourage local students to go to colleges. And that's why relationship with high schools, partnership with local industry is going to be more challenging for schools like ours in order for us to overcome the demographic challenge.
Leading a college or school of business is no small task, and it's one that finds a lot of churn in many deans' offices. That's up next.
Life sometimes has a way of interfering with our university education. Marriage, family, work, any or all of these can cause us to hit the pause button on our degree, with hopes of one day finishing it. The only problem is that returning to campus can get a lot harder when you're no longer 20 years old. And that's precisely why we launched our online BBA. With majors in accounting, finance, general business, marketing, management, human resource management, and computer information systems. Available completely online. You can return to school without having to step foot on campus. Or maybe you want to transfer in from a two-year program elsewhere, but once again, are not able to attend face-to-face. Our online offerings are for you as well. We can help you finish your degree and climb higher on your career ladder, at your pace and in your time. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WTBBA in hand. For more info, find us at wtnu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525.
I think the job of a dean has changed. because the dean now is not only a chief academic officer of a college, he's a marketer, he's a fundraiser, he needs to work with faculty, he needs to work with administrators. So the role has changed because the challenges and the demands has changed. So you always, as a dean, work with lots of competing interests and try to be able to really prioritize how you deal with those interests is becoming a challenge. As I said, 10 years ago, no one would thought the dean needs to be a marketer. For me, as a dean right now, I need to know about and learn how to market the college, how to market the programs, how to work with stakeholders. And those are competing interests, how to make sure that when you have a decline in enrollment challenges, how you worry about the quality and enrollment, and you have to work this is. You have faculty shared governance and academic freedom. Those are the challenges right now are becoming more and more to the surface than they used like 10 years ago.
There's a big difference going from being a department head or an associate dean and then into the dean's position. The complexity raises manyfold because there's just so many things going on and you're accountable for everything that happens, no matter what. So let's talk about some more of those challenges. Why is this such a hard job? Why is there so much turnover? And I did some Googling yesterday and discovered that the average career length of an NFL quarterback is only 5 years. The average tenure of a school of business dean is only 4 years. Is being a dean harder than being a quarterback?
I don't know about that, but you know, business deans, you're right. I mean, they don't, the average tenure in a position is less than 5 years nowadays. Very few deans will last 10 or 15 years. I mean, that is unheard of. And there are different reasons for that. It could be sometimes motivated by careers moves. It could be motivated by family issues or personal life. But in general, being a dean requires you to be more of, especially nowadays, you need to have a mindset of agility and innovations. And that is sometimes is not conducive to traditional academic culture, because academic culture is very stable. It requires me longer time to go and make changes. And also, business deans, generally speaking, are required to have a fast results and turnover and make sure that you are making the changes fast enough. But if you take a look at the skill set that is needed and the traditional academic models, they are competing with, they are not compatible, they are not aligned. So this is why you will see that deans always seek a different opportunity somewhere else to make sure that it is aligned with their goals, with their objectives. Not necessarily it is difficult or not, but it is complex, as I told you, as the role has changed and the demand has changed on that particular role.
I see you wearing many hats. You have the HR hat, ultimately. You're in charge of everybody here, and you've got hiring, firing, all the things that go into managing that aspect of the school. But you still teach some, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so now you're a professor. What about fundraiser? Do you court donors?
Well, you are required to. You are expected to. One of the things is, I think any college that has a good relationship with its alumni and its community, that's a good college, because sometimes you are judged by the support you get from your alumni and your local partnerships. Fortunately, we are able, as a college, we are able to attract and get support from our stakeholder. And I think we're fortunate in being able to do that. And to me, that tells you about the health of the college and the respect of the college when you have your alumni and your partners within the community are willing to invest in you. The investment is not necessarily in the buildings or in equipment, rather than this is, for my perspective, is investment in providing financial support for students. And I think our students, when companies and alumni sees the opportunities that they were provided with when they were students and the type of graduates we have, you can see this is a vote of confidence when you are getting financial support from your alumni, from your partnership here. As a dean, yes, you are expected to go and be able to raise money, and that is this is why the role has changed, because if you don't raise money, then you will not be able to get enough scholarship to support your students.
Yeah, I remember a dean many years ago. This basically addresses the rising complexity of the dean's office, because for that particular dean, it was kind of a 9-to-3 job, and with a long lunch. and I see the long hours that you put in. I get emails from you early in the morning or in the evening, and I see you here during the day for many hours. I don't know that I've ever seen you take a lunch break unless you are going to a meeting somewhere that also happens to be serving lunch. You're just going all day long.
Well, I think the role of the dean, as I told you, has changed. And what you really need to do is you have to do the job is not 9-to-5. If you expect that this job is going to be take 6 hours to do the job, then you're not being an effective dean. Effective deans needs to be aware of both the internal challenges, the external challenges, explore both the internal opportunities and the external opportunities. And sometimes you really have to prioritize what you have to do. So any dean who thinks it is 9-to-5 job, I don't think they would be able to be successful. But working hard is not like working smart. What you need to do is you really need to be able to identify the task you want to work on. And sometimes certain tasks does not happen during the day. That means you are working from home, you're working from the office. And that's why, you know, thank you for the comments about getting emails in the morning or late night. But those are where you really have a schedule and you need to make sure you push the tasks and get them done. It doesn't matter. The task has to be done. It doesn't matter when, or it doesn't have to be that during 9-to-5.
So here you are, 6 years, 2 months. You're beating the odds. You know, you're way above average at this point.
Barely.
compared to all the other deans. How do you get up every morning and say, let's go do this again?
This is a very good question, because sometimes the older you get, the different perspective you take about jobs and life. And if you are not a believer of what you do, then you really will not be able to go ahead and do the job. I spent 26 years here in the college. And to me, is part of my life. So the college became a part of my success, a part of my professional life. And what really makes me going is that the ability to make sure that we are making a difference in our students' lives. There is nothing like a graduation when you see your students over 3 years, 4 years, and they will come to you and will say, you know, thank you for what the college has done for us. So what really motivates me the most is our ability to make sure that we are making a difference in our students' lives. What we are doing is we're taking students who probably, when they come to join us, might be on the scales of a skill set from 1 to 10, maybe they are 6, and we do a good job in making them 8 and maybe 9. And when you hear their success stories, that's where the gratifications and the motivations for keep going comes from.
What about burnout? When I Googled deans and their tenure of service and so forth, that was a phrase that came up in the AI overview. It specifically said burnout. Have you experienced that? Seeing other deans go through that, or have you ever felt yourself like?
Sure. I think this is a normal cycle that everybody go through a burnout, but what you really need to do is you need to motivate yourself and believe what you are doing. And if you don't really believe what you are doing, then you really cannot continue to do it. If you approach it as a job and you're coming from 9-to-5, and then you're not going to be able to make a difference. As a dean, as someone who's been here for a long time and seeing a lot of things, is you really need to have a higher calling for you to keep going and keep you aware of the challenges. You know, sometimes being competitive in your life is a good factor that will allow you to keep going. Otherwise, you probably will say, why do I want to go through all of those challenges? You know, being a dean is not a fun job, because you are sandwiched between administrations and faculty. And you really have to manage lots of egos and a lots of personalities. And you really have to work through a lots of things. And no one knows exactly what's the right answer or the wrong answers. But the belief of what you do and the commitment that you have is what, for me, that's what keeps me going.
There's one last topic that we must discuss. And, well, that's the most important change facing business and society in many years. That is coming up after the break.
The demand for professionals in data analytics and information systems far exceeds the supply, which is why the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business developed the Masters of Science in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics degree program. Already, external reviewers have ranked it among the highest IS programs in the nation. We are an AACSB accredited college and among the most elite business schools around the world. Available completely online, this program will help you transform businesses and propel them far into the 21st century. Data mining, data analytics, and data science are keys to your success, and we provide the key to unlock your future. Reach for the stars with a West Texas A&M Master's in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics. For more info, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
There have been many paradigm shifts in our time, from computing to e-commerce in particular, but it is AI, which is the logical extension of everything we have done in computing as well as commerce. While it has been building slowly in the background for many years, it was not until late November 2022 that it entered the lexicon of the common man, and now it's everywhere. So let's talk about AI, because before then, yeah, I talked about it in my classes, but that was kind of a topic just for higher ed people, you know, nerdy people who happen to spend a lot of time with computers. We talked about AI a lot, but when OpenAI unleashed ChatGPT to the masses that month, suddenly it wound up in everybody's toolbox. So what are your thoughts on this, Amjad, and where it's going and how it's going to affect us in higher ed?
Wow, I think AI is a disruptive force. And I don't think anyone has the right answer yet because we are living it. I mean, if you take a look at the technological changes, usually it is not as fast as what you are experiencing here. So from my perspective is AI is not is a challenge that needs to be embraced. It is already shaping what we teach, how we teach it, and why students choose us. The real challenge is not whether we adopt AI, it is how to adopt without losing the core of business educations. And that is critical thinking, judgment, and ethical leadership. So we need to be really not to be following just the technology. We need to make sure that we still have those three core values. So AI is forcing business educations to confront the hard truth, and that is we have spent years of teaching students how to do the work, and now AI can do the work better and faster and cheaper. So the question becomes, what is the value of a business degree, or what do we do? It is no longer about building spreadsheets or writing reports. It's about asking the right questions, interpreting AI output, making decisions under uncertainty, and doing that ethically. When we talk about AI, we really need to understand the ethical components of how it is used and how it is applied. So at the same time, we are dealing with real tensions, whether it's how the curriculum changes, how faculty are at different levels and readiness, what the students expect. And if we don't adapt quickly, the market will respond differently, and that's where the relevance becomes important. So schools that are going to win are the ones that don't chase every new tool. So if you are going to chase every new tool, every new topic, I don't think you will be successful. But instead, redesign the programs. And the way you design the programs, it needs to be designed around judgment, leadership, and responsible use of AI. It is how it is used to make sound decision. If you think of calculators, Calculators, when we before it was used, allowed to be used in schools, students used to spend lots of time talking about the process of calculations. And when the calculators and the computer became now, the focus was not on the process of calculations, it's the process of interpretations, what that data means. And so the same thing is happening right now with AI. The ability is not to teach tools rather than how to use the tool to make more informed decisions or better decisions with ethical framework.
I talk about AI all the time in my marketing classes. They're probably sick of hearing about it by now, but I feel like they need to learn as much as they possibly can and figure out what parts of it they want to embrace and the parts they don't want to. And one thing that I have discovered working with my students is that when I presented them with the possibility that AI could create an entire marketing campaign, can write music, ad jingles, all these things, they pushed back. They were all Generation Z, and they were more concerned about the authenticity, and they saw those AI applications as being not as authentic as if a human had created the campaign or written the song and the lyrics and performed it. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is where the ethical component comes. And, you know, every generation, I mean, remember the type of students you had when you first came here. It has changed. I think authenticity is becoming a very important component in terms of who owns what has been done. And I think we are under severe pressure with the digital world because, you know, whether it's privacy issues, whether it is about copyright issues, or whether this is authentic, I don't think we really have figured out what's the right answer. I think the new generation is highly connected to the digital world, and in their own way, they make value judgment based on their life experience without really trying to understand more of the previous life experience, how they can incorporate it. Because if you go back to you and I, we are almost in the same ages. In the 80s, computing was more about efficiencies, and now computer is more about productivities. It's more about making the right decisions. It is how to make decisions rather than just to achieve efficiency. So there is an evolution in the way we interpret educations. The type of the new students we have right now is, I think they have their own moral values because it's shaped by the negative side of technology. And I think we should applaud that. We should not really look at it down because I think they're smart enough to recognize that is not real and that is not genuine and that's not authentic. And we really need to applaud that and respect what they are saying because if you take a look at the social media now, you don't know who's who. Anything could be duplicated. And that's where the challenge about AI, because we need to be careful about the three things. One is jobs, and the other one is the environment. And those might not be issues that many people want to deal with, but from my perspective, I think the younger generations are more in tune to it than people are in my age or my age group.
You mentioned the environment. Boy, that is a hot potato right now everywhere, not just in Amarillo. AI requires exponentially more computing power, and which means electricity and water are going to be needed. I was looking at an online application yesterday from a major software as a service company, and I thought that my monthly subscription to the whole suite of products was going to give me unlimited access to this one new thing they had. And it was like, oh, no. I get very limited access. I would have to buy a bunch of credits because of the vast computing power that it needs to be able to do this. And basically, it involved being able to generate video from my own content. But it's so easy to use the software application because of its AI. That's the beauty of it, but that's also the downside of it. How are we going to navigate these times here when the data centers are requiring so many resources?
I think that's a challenge many municipalities are dealing with right now. And I think some cities now, they are trying to put a stop on how many data centers they are allowed to have. And you're right, it is going to be there's a competition for energy. Who's going to be, how are we going to power those huge data centers? And if you are in an area where water is important and energy is not and energy is expensive, you have to prioritize, is it going to be used for this area or that area? So from my perspective, what I see is, at one point there will be a need for regulations in terms of how much use of energy or water for those data center to be powered. Because every city has their own data center. Every company might have their own data center because the amount of data that is being captured, it's a huge. So what I see at one point is we might have a higher level of concentrations of data so we can achieve higher level of efficiencies so we can minimize the usage of energy and water.
Some people argue that AI is so good that it is going to eliminate a lot of jobs, even professors, because let's face it, if students can generate essays and reports on ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever platform you like, a professor could do the same thing, right? I prefer to think of AI as a tool for discovery. I can use it to get ideas, to get inspiration, and then I can run with it and put my knowledge and experience into it. And I compare it to the old days, you know, when we had textbooks and textbook reps actually called on us in our offices, and they weren't just selling the book that the students would get. They were also selling this 6-inch stack of supplemental materials for the professor. And you know what was inside a lot of those supplements? Lecture outlines and PowerPoints or transparencies before we had PowerPoint.
I remember those, yeah.
So actually, it's no different in my mind. If they had supplements that provided lecture outlines 30 years ago, they didn't need professors then either, did they? Unless the professor took it as inspiration to dig in and go the extra mile and show the students, now this is why this is important. And here's some examples. What are your thoughts on this?
I think you're absolutely right. I think AI is going to change how we teach and how we learn and how we present our content. If the idea will be write reports only, then AI can do it for you. So what we really need to focus on is how we can apply critical thinking skills, problem solving, interpretations, how we rely on data to be informative for our decision making when there is uncertainty in doing this. Those skills are not going to be taken over by AI. So if we are going to focus about problem solving and decision making, then AI cannot do any of those, is because garbage in is garbage out. So what does it mean when you have, for example, remember when we used to teach statistics and they said, well, 95% confidence, what does that mean? Well, you can calculate it. If you don't interpret it and you cannot really make sense out of it, then it doesn't matter. So our challenge would be as a faculty, how we can infuse decision-making and problem-solving in our students. So when we present materials, we have to change the process from just doing the things to how they can interpret it to make value judgment and decision-making.
So let's return to the curriculum. Are we reaching the point where we are going to have standalone courses in every discipline, like AI in marketing or AI in management or AI in finance or accounting or whatever? Is that what's going to happen, or is this something we just need to figure out, kind of like ethics, how to weave it in to every possible lecture or topic that we pursue?
You know, I think what I would do is there's a shift from doing the work to thinking about the work. So it doesn't matter. I think if you think every problem is going to be solved by throwing a course, that's the easy solution. Remember when we used to have, like, we need to have a course in ethics, a course in globalization, in global issues, a course in IT. I don't think that is the solution. The solution is going to be you need to have a holistic approach where you embedded decision-making skill sets into the entire curriculum. So you can't have just a course AI in finance, AI in this and AI in that. You really have to embed it in the entire curriculum. Throwing a course by itself is not going to be the solution. It's like, you know, statistics. You don't, you know, when you say statistic for ag, statistic for business, statistic is the statistics. The idea would be is how you interpret it, how you think about the work rather than what does the work need to be done.
My guest today has been Dr. Amjad Abdullah, Dean of the Engler College of Business. Thanks for being on the show again, Amjad, and I give you a special thank you for making this podcast possible. We now have 4 years under our belt.
Well, thank you for having me, and you don't know how proud I am for being able to have that forum, not only for me to come in, this is my second time, but the opportunity to for our students, our stakeholders to see different type of individuals coming and participate in this forum. And many thanks to you for taking the lead and run with it. So I appreciate your hard work and your innovations.
Fade to black, roll credits.
You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our Director of Marketing and Outreach Initiatives, which includes overseeing BuffSpeak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is Director of Accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdullah is Dean of the College. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/COB for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to BuffSpeak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! BuffSpeak.